What if the most radical act of self-care isn't your morning matcha or a perfect Pilates class at Mantra, but what's actually on your plate? Welcome to Embodied, the podcast where we talk about what it really means to live a conscious and connected life, all while having a little fun doing it. I'm your host, Kathy Covington. Today, we're pulling back the green curtain on the word organic. What does it really mean? Is it worth the price tag? And how did it go from a niche idea in the 70s to a multi-billion dollar movement? And what if the most powerful thing you can actually do for your health isn't another workout or wellness trend? It's what you decide to put on your plate. Joining me today is Joseph Stern, who's been at the heart of this story since the very beginning. Joseph built one of the very first organic food distribution companies in the U.S. way before organic was even cool, going on to source organic foods for major brands like Whole Foods, Trader Joe's, Target, and many, many more. This episode is about educating you on the choices you can make when it comes to how you fuel your body. Because when we understand where our food comes from, we can understand ourselves and our beautiful planet in a deeper and more meaningful way. And welcome, Joseph. How are you?
Thanks, Kathy. It's great to be here with you to talk about this.
I'm really happy you're here, and I'm excited to learn more. Before we get started into the details of the organic food movement, I'd love to start at the beginning with your personal journey. What inspired you to step into this field back in the 1970s when organic was still really a fringe idea?
Well, that's a great question. I was your typical person who ate all kinds of food growing up and had all kinds of digestive disorders and issues with my own health. And one day, after doing a six-week-long workshop at Esalen Institute in Big Sur, where they have an amazing organic garden there that was modeled after the Findhorn garden in Scotland, I started to learn about organic agriculture, succession planning, companion planning, and how to grow food in the old-fashioned way, in a healthier way, without pesticides and chemicals. And I realized back in 1974 that cancer was really only becoming a big issue in terms of people's death rate. For the last really 50 years prior to 1974 is when it kind of started. And that's when we started putting lots of pesticides and herbicides and chemicals into our food as we were growing food. And I realized that not only were we eating those pesticides and chemicals, but they're going into the groundwater and people are bathing in it, which means they're drinking it. And they were also drinking it. And so I realized at a young age of 22 years old that we needed to go back to organic farming. And it was kind of a light bulb went off in my head. And after that workshop, I went back to the suburbs of Philadelphia, which is where I grew up. And I started farming organically there. I tilled virgin land by hand, by shovel. And I tilled this soil with my Troy-Bilt rototiller that I had back then. And I wound up growing 50 different fruits and vegetables and herbs. And I realized that it was an amazing, I learned so much, but it was also an amazing amount of work. It was extremely labor intense. And after 2 years of doing that, I wanted to do organics in a different level. So I had saved up some money when I was a kid from all the jobs that I had. And with $5,000 that I saved up, I started Earthly Organics in Philadelphia, and I became one of the first distributors in the East Coast to start selling natural and organic foods into supermarkets on the East Coast, and 7-Elevens and Wawa's, and believe it or not, I was even selling to hospitals and university food service outlets back then. And I built that company up over 10 years and wound up selling it to Cornucopia, who wound up becoming UNFI, United Natural Food Distributors. And they're the largest distributor of natural foods in the country. And I was their first acquisition back in 1985, before they were even a public company or called what they are today. So that's how I kind of got into it back in the beginning. And later in my life, I wound up starting a company called Organic Ingredients here in Santa Cruz, California. And I wound up at the end of my career with Organic Ingredients, I wound up making all kinds of private label retail products for Whole Foods and Trader Joe's and Costco and Safeway and Walmart and Starbucks and baby food companies and juice companies, many major brands that you know of today. And at one point we had 35 food manufacturing facilities making almost every brand out there of soy milk and oat milk and rice milk and almond milk and juices and soups and salsas and pasta sauces and fruit bars, all kinds of products, frozen fruits and vegetables. And it was an amazing career where I got to source organic ingredients from 60 countries at the peak of my career. And we were exporting to 47 countries.
That's truly incredible. And out of curiosity, can you just tell me more about back in the 1970s? What was the food industry like when you started Earthly Organics?
Well, organic food was very hard to find on the East Coast. When I went to California in 74, I started seeing some organic products on the shelves. But keep in mind, back then, there was no official law as to what organic meant. So people were putting organic on labels without any kind of legal way of doing so, because there was no law saying what organic was. Back in the mid-70s in Philadelphia, even health food stores did not sell food. They were just vitamin shops like general nutrition stores where they sold vitamins and supplements. There was no food in health food stores back in the 70s. So it was not pretty much non-existent, and it just started really in the 70s on the East Coast. And today it's evolved to the point where now 6% of the total food sales in the United States are organic. Back then, I'm sure it was less than 0.1%, if that at all. So it was a very different landscape back then as to what it is today. And today we have regulations that I can talk about how the organic law came into effect, but that might be for another question.
Yeah, that's exciting. It's a fascinating story, and it's incredible to think about how it's changed since those earlier days and what's going on now. I would love to explore with you more about organic. You mentioned all the certifications, but also what does organic mean today? Mm-hmm. And how that definition has evolved over time.
Sure. Well, back in 1993, the California Food Act of 1993 stipulated by Congress that the USDA had to come up with a definition of organic and had to set up the criteria and requirements for what constituted an organic label. And it took until about the year 2000 before the USDA actually came out with its first draft of what the organic law was supposed to be. And when they first published what the law was going to be, they were going to allow sewage sludge, irradiation of food, and GMOs. And we in the organic industry were extraordinarily opposed to that, because none of that is organic. And we fought it. We got a record number of 400,000 letters to the USDA back in 2000-2001. And in 2001, the USDA changed the law to not allow sewage sludge, not allow GMOs, and not allow irradiation of foods. And we got the law passed to what we wanted it as an industry. We wanted a high bar. You know, the word natural doesn't mean anything, but the word organic now does mean something. And it's a very lengthy document, the organic law, but to summarize it in a nutshell, it means that a farmer who's growing any kind of fruit or vegetable or grain or bean or nut or seed, any kind of food, and these are all plant-based foods. This did not apply to animals. This is strictly plants and vegetables. And it required that the farmer had to grow using organic methods for a period of 3 years of organic farming before it could be certified as organic. If it's virgin land, then you could actually start farming it organically right away and get certified. And what there is the USDA set up certification agencies So there's ones such as QAI, Quality Assurance International, or Oregon Tilth, or the state of Washington, the state of Florida. There's over 60 different certification agencies just in North America. There's others around the world, but in North America, these independent third-party certification agencies, they audit all of us in the supply chain. So it's not just the growers, it's the food processors, it's the warehousers, it's the transportation companies, the storage and warehousing facilities. Everybody in the supply chain gets audited by these third-party certification agencies each and every year. And each of these certification agencies are audited by the USDA themselves. So once you are certified, you have to pay money to get certified to these agencies, and then they do their audits and they check all of your inputs and they make sure that you're doing everything in accordance with the organic regulations. And if you are, then you can become certified as an organic supplier. And we have had many different agencies around the world also get certified by the USDA. So, for example, if you're buying strawberries or raspberries or blueberries from Chile or from Mexico, the question often comes up, well, how do I know if it's organic coming from those other countries? Well, the reason we know it is because any foreign certification agencies that are not inside the United States, they also have to be accredited by the USDA in order for their product and their farmers and their suppliers to be certified. So anything coming from offshore that is organic, we have reciprocity agreements with various countries around the world, and there's a common understanding of what qualifies as organic. So whenever you see the USDA logo, usually they're either black and white or yellow and green, or it's the round logo that says USDA organic. Whenever you see that on a product, you can have a very high degree of confidence that the food was grown in accordance with the organic principles based on the USDA regulations. And it's all under the umbrella of the National Organic Program, the NOP. The NOP is the organic law that we live by in the United States.
The NOP being the official system that sets and enforces what we can actually legally be called organic here in the U.S. and yep. abroad is what you're saying for both.
Yep, that is correct.
Okay.
The National Organic Program. So that's what Congress put into place. The USDA finally defined it. And now we in the industry, we all live by those regulations.
Going back to what you were touching on before about all the regulations for international and national, a big question I think a lot of people have when you're bringing in products from different countries, the credibility of the and to actually be able to certify that it truly is organic food and the safety of that food that's being brought into the U.S.
Yeah, that's a question that I get asked a lot. You know, how do we really know if it's organic, if it's coming from another country? And that is because these third-party independent certification agencies that accredit any grower or food processor, they also are audited by the USDA. So there's some variations in the law, say, between the EU and the United States. When I was in the industry, we have the Organic Trade Association, and it's a group of all the companies that, you know, are in the supply chain of organic in the United States. And I was on the International Relations Committee. And when, after the law was put into place, we wanted to be able to buy ingredients from Europe or from South America or from Japan or from China or from anywhere. And in order to do that, we had to have a reciprocity agreement between our governments. So I was involved in some of the negotiations between Japan and the United States and the EU and the United States and Mexico and Canada, for example. And in Europe, they only had a one-year conversion period. We have a three-year conversion period. But in Europe, they have much stricter standards when it comes to organic meat. we had more lax standards in the United States when it came to organic meat. It's a very involved and detailed list that I don't want to bore your audience with, but let's just say that we found common ground between countries so that we could trade in ingredients and finished product, consumer products, and legitimately call it organic. There's a lot of checks and balances in the system. I mentioned that there's audits that get done every year, but there's also competitors. You know, in any business, there's cheaters. There's people that try to get away with stuff. In organic, it's very hard for anybody to cheat or get away with anything because a neighboring farm knows what their neighbor is doing and what inputs they're putting into their soil. And I remember a time when I was the first person to start bringing natural and organic non-GMO and orange juice, not from concentrate orange juice, into North America. And I had a lot of farmers in Mexico that were trying to all of a sudden become organic. Well, the neighboring farms realized that they were cheating. They were trying to fast track the process. And we blew the whistle. We went to the USDA and let them know what was going on. And those product that fruit never came to the market. It never even made it onto the shelf because 9 out of 10 times, if there's a cheater, they get caught before the product ever goes to market. And there have been some instances where there have been cheaters, and the USDA has pulled the plug and blown the whistle on them, fined them, and prevented them from going into business. So you can be really, really confident when you go to bed at night. If you bought an organic product, whether it comes from the United States or it comes from any foreign country, it truly and legitimately was grown in accordance with the National Organic Program and followed all the rules and regulations that are required to be called and certified organic.
Wow, that's very comforting to know. I've often asked that question myself when it's coming from abroad, if in fact it's safe, and how do they regulate that, and if it is protected by the USDA organic label.
And to give you a little further idea, like for example, because there's a stigma associated with product, for example, coming from China. China had a lot of food quality problems. They had the melamine in baby food and pet food years ago, and that gave China a very bad name in terms of being a supply source. Yet I could tell you that we sourced, for example, organic broccoli from virgin farms in a region in China that was never farmed conventionally. And we had quality control people that went to monitor, besides the certification agencies that oversee everything. We didn't trust it. We companies that are publicly traded companies, that are large companies, we had to do our own due diligence, and we didn't want to just trust the whole process with the USDA. So we had our own auditors go in there. And then to further make sure that there was integrity in the system, we pesticide residue tested every single lot of frozen organic broccoli, for example, that we brought in, that we sold to Costco and other companies. And we made sure that even though we had certification, even though everything was legitimate with the certification agencies and the USDA, we still took further steps to ensure the fact that the food was clean and free of pesticides and grown in accordance with the organic principles.
That's very comforting. You were saying you tested for pesticides. So part of the USDA organic being organic is actually, how does that work? I don't understand the rules and the laws behind pesticides and the use of pesticides in organic farming.
So there's no chemical pesticides or herbicides that are allowed in organic farming. There are some biological methods to control pests. There are pheromones that are used in the fields. There's companion planting. There's all different kinds of techniques that are allowed. But what's not allowed is the use of any kinds of chemicals, pesticides, herbicides that are toxic. And it's a process with which you grow. It is not a, for example, there's drift. So people say, well, if a farmer next door is using pesticides, how do we know that some of those pesticides don't drift in the wind to the organic farmer next door? Well, the fact is that drift is a real thing. And there can be some drift that could go into organic farms from non-organic farms. The law allows for a certain amount of drift. So because you're buying something organic does not mean it's 100% pesticide free. It does mean that there's got to be less, and forgive me, I don't know the exact statistic, but it's some minute percentage of parts per billion that is allowed because of drift, because the pesticides, chemicals, pollution is in our air. It's everywhere in our environment. Organic means that you have grown the product in accordance with the organic principles. And as long as there's not the threshold of what is tolerable is breached, then the product can still be called organic.
Got it. That makes sense. With regards to organic foods, is there a nutritional difference between organic and conventional food? If you're buying organic broccoli versus conventional broccoli?
Yes.
Okay.
That's a great question. I'm not a scientist, but I have read many different scientific articles and research that has been done. And it has been shown that food that is grown sustainably, regeneratively, and organically has higher nutritional value than regularly farmed produce that has been farmed with chemicals and pesticides. The food actually contains higher nutritional value. And it tastes better. I think that if you go and you eat an organic tomato fresh out of the field versus a tomato that's been grown conventionally, you'll see that there's a tremendous difference in taste. So there's a higher nutritional value as well as taste in organic.
I often find that the organic foods are a little bit more flavorful. And one of the other things that comes up for me, and maybe you could clarify too, a couple of things. The first one being when I'm purchasing, for example, organic blueberries. I notice that the blueberries are really big and plump. They're certified organic, but they say certified organic non-GMO. And the blueberries are so big and plump that it makes me think, hey, maybe those are actually genetically modified, yet they still carry the organic label.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? I'm wondering what causes that and how do they get the produce the fruit to ripen up and be so tasty and so delicious? That makes sense. Just the quality and the safety of what I'm buying when I'm buying these big, giant, beautiful USDA labeled blueberries. They don't even look natural.
Well, that's a good question in terms of the difference between non-GMO and organic. To be really clear, if you're buying something that's organic, it's automatically non-GMO. GMOs are not allowed in organic, period. So if you're buying something, it's automatically non-GMO. However, if you buy something that does not have the organic logo seal on saying that it's organic, but it has the non-GMO verified logo with the little check mark and the little butterfly, if it says it's non-GMO, but it's not organic, it could still be grown with tons of chemicals and pesticides that are harmful to your body and to the environment. So buying non-GMO is not enough. Buying organic automatically means non-GMO. It's a much higher standard and a much higher bar in terms of quality of what you're getting. In terms of your big blueberries,
in my big plump blueberries.
In terms of your big plump blueberries, when you grow food organically in healthy soil, whether it's blueberries or whatever it is, the soil quality is healthier. The microorganisms in the soil are healthier. When you're monocropping and you're tilling the soil, you're killing the topsoil. You're killing all the earthworms, all the microorganisms that are in the topsoil. So the quality of the food is not as good. It doesn't taste as good. The nutritional value is not as great. But when you're farming organically, especially sustainably and regeneratively, the soil health is so much vastly different and better than it is conventionally farmed. It's ridiculous. So yeah, the food comes out bigger, plumper, tastier, and more nutritious. I remember back in the 90s when we were like the first to really start selling organic tomato paste and diced tomatoes to all the pasta manufacturers, the pasta sauce manufacturers. My organic farmers in California, it's a 3-year conversion period, remember, and those 3 years are tough. The farmer loses yield. He loses yield and he takes losses. So that 3-year conversion period is painful for farmers to convert. But once they convert and the soil starts getting healthier again, my organic farmers confessed to me after year 4 and 5, they were getting better yields with less inputs and less cost than when they were farming it conventionally. So I naturally said, well, then why can't I buy the organic cheaper? Because if they didn't have to spend as much for the pesticides and chemicals and they were getting better yields, that means they should be able to sell for less than conventional. And of course, they didn't lower their prices that much, but it was still a premium above conventional. But they had to make up for the 3 years where they were losing money because of the conversion.
Interesting. Yeah. So going back into the, not to bring up the blueberries too much, but going back into the blueberries. So when you're, for anybody wondering, non-GMO simply means that the crops haven't been genetically modified in a lab. But that Correct. Does not automatically make something organic. It's just part of a much bigger picture. Correct?
Yeah, non-GMO, they can still use pesticides and herbicides and all kinds of toxic chemicals to grow it. It's just that they didn't use genetically modified organisms.
Got it. And so the USDA organic label is actually the gold standard in the US. And it means that the product met all the national, the NOP, right, National Organic Programs, the strict requirements. And it's Correct. How it's basically from how it's farmed, what you're mentioning, how it's farmed and actually how it's handled and how it's processed and distributed, I would take.
That's absolutely correct, Kathy. Yes.
Okay. All right. Just trying to get clarity with that, because there's so many labels out there. It's hard to figure out which is which and which ones we should look for when we're shopping in the grocery store. Another question that comes up too is cost wise. Say when we're, you know, a young family or learns over the cost of organic versus the cost of buying regular non-organic foods. Are there any particular foods that if someone who is being conscientious of cost could make sure that they always buy organic, and maybe others that they're, you know, you could say, you know, if you don't necessarily have to, if you had to get by?
Yeah. The very worst food in the world you could buy is a fresh strawberry if it's not been grown organically. Strawberries are the most toxic fruit on the planet if they've been grown conventionally versus organic. That is the one single food. Any fruit or vegetable that has porous skin, hasn't have a hard peel on it,
right?
Or is dangerous. But strawberries are like the number one worst food you could possibly eat if it's not organic. There's others on the list, but that's the one food to stay away from.
Avocados, bananas.
Avocados are not so bad, actually. If they're conventional, they're not as bad as other product because of the types of pesticides and chemicals that they use are not quite as prolific and bad for you. Also, the avocado has a good skin on it.
So I guess moving on back to the state of the organic market in the U.S., can you comment on current landscape of demand and supply for organic ingredients? I know you and I have had a conversation about that in the past.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned demand and supply. If you could just expand on that a little bit more.
Yeah. Let's see. Right when I retired 11 years ago, after doing organic ingredients in SunOpta and when I was sourcing from 60 countries, at that time, overall food sales in the United States, organic was only 5%. So here we are 11 years later in 2025, and organic food sales are only 6% today of the total food sales in the United States.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, and yet less than 1% of the land in America is farmed organically. So in order to feed the demand of the American palate for organic, we have to source from outside the United States to meet the demand. There's not enough food grown locally in America to feed the demand of the American consumer. Right now, today, the organic food sales in America is a $60 billion industry. In certain commodities, it's much higher. Like, for example, produce, anywhere from 15 to 30% of the produce in America is now purchased as organic. And dairy, cow milk is another big one. It's also in the 15 to 25% range, depending on the year and the supermarket chain that you're measuring it, the volume with. But overall, it's just 6% of total food sales right now, and less than 1% of the land. So the demand continues to outpace the supply, and the whole industry continues to be supply constrained. And that's why I started back in 1996, Organic Ingredients, my last company, because I recognized that we could not source enough locally, and we had to source from other countries in order to meet the demand of the American consumer.
So that's where you realize that global sourcing was actually something that was needed, in order to meet the demands of the organic needs of the US consumer.
Yes, that's correct. I literally scoured the earth to find organic, legitimate organic product that we could then put into, different products in the United States for all the different supermarket chains that we talked about before.
Incredible. And that's and so you sourced, you said you sourced from more than 60 countries.
Yes, I did. I sourced from 60 countries at the time when I retired in 11 years ago.
Wow. Tis incredible, Joseph. And what would you say is your number was your number one? You mentioned China,
Well, it depends on the
South
commodity.
America.
Yeah, Chile was a fantastic source for organic strawberries and raspberries and blackberries and asparagus. Different countries specialize in different types of crops. We also wanted to have contra-seasonality, so we wanted to source from the southern hemisphere as well as the northern hemisphere of the planet, because when it's not growing season in North America, it is growing season in South America. And with global weather changing all the time, and crop failures in different countries in different seasons at different times, it was very important to be able to diversify our sources of supply from a contra-seasonal standpoint as well as from a geographical standpoint.
Incredible. That leads to the importance of farming practices and how they shape our planet's health. You talked about sustainable and regenerative agriculture and tilling of the soil. Go back into that conversation and how do these practices go beyond traditional organic standards and why they're so vital for the future of our soil?
Well, modern agriculture, I'll call modern agriculture in the last, 100 years, we've got big agribusinesses now. We have big corporations that are monocropping. They're growing one thing at a time over vast spaces of land. And we're tilling the soil. And when we're tilling the soil, we're destroying the topsoil. Our soil, a healthy soil, has the ability to pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and convert it into oxygen. Everybody talks about climate change and the effects of climate change and what's going on our planet right now. It's obviously we've reached a tipping point and we're seeing more extreme weather all over the world. And everybody points their finger at fossil fuels and all the car emissions and plane emissions and ship and all the different fossil fuels that are burned. They are a huge contributing factor to climate change, no question about it. However, the biggest contributor to climate change is the way we're doing agriculture on our planet right now. Monocropping and tilling of the soil is destroying the topsoil's ability to take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and converting into oxygen.
And so just summarizing, when you say monocropping, when you hear the term monocropping, just to clarify, that's when the large farms grow the same crop over and over again, right? On the same land, like corn, maybe soy, that can actually deplete the soil, and then it makes farming less sustainable over time, correct?
That's absolutely correct. Yes. Yeah. So not only is that a factor, but you have a compounding factor that's affecting this. And that is, 100 years ago, we humans on this planet were consuming about 1/100th of the amount of cows, pigs, and chickens that we're eating today. And over the last 100 years, our population on the planet has grown significantly. And you have to feed a cow 16 grams of plant protein to get back 1 gram of plant protein for human consumption. So the reason they're cutting down the Amazon jungle and we're losing so much forest land in on the planet is because countries are cutting down forests so they can grow more plants to feed more animals to feed humans. And it's not a sustainable model. We don't have enough land mass on the planet to continue on the direction that we're going right now. The amount of water resources, the amount of land resources that is required to grow food to feed animals that feed humans is the biggest single contributor to climate change, more so than all the fossil fuels combined. So that doesn't mean we all need to become vegetarians overnight. However, if we all ate less meat and more plant-based protein, not only would we be healthier in our own bodies, because it is clearly a healthier lifestyle for humans to eat a more plant-based diet, but we'd also could affect the way in which we're doing agriculture on this planet. And in my mind, that is it's not just my mind, but it's a fact that the biggest contributor to climate change is the way we're doing farming right now, and especially the magnitude of farming that is being done to feed cows, pigs, and chickens. And so we need to, you know, if we want to have a healthier body, we could do healthier ways of agriculture, and we could actually reverse climate change if we all were more mindful about what we're eating and putting into our body.
We were talking about produce before, more produce and fruits, but you're bringing up meat. The USDA does regulate meat, dairy, and eggs as well, right? And I think if I'm correct on that, if it's something's USDA organic, does it need to be protected in any way? In other words, like, do they have to roam freely outdoors for a chicken? Are there things in the U.S. when we buy organic meat? In particular, that we know that the animals have been cared for in a particular way.
The organic law for dairy and for animals came a little bit later than fruits and vegetables. And yes, there are regulations on it. We do not in the United States, we do not have any organic regulations for seafood, FYI. Europe, the EU does. So when you're in Europe, you could buy organic salmon from Norway, for example. But we don't have any certification for organic seafood in the United States. But we certainly do for animals. And animals that are grown organically, they're not fed hormones. They're not fed antibiotics. They have to have so much time outdoors. However, There are mass farms of, you know, organic cow production for dairy. And though it is definitely better than conventional because you're not getting hormones and antibiotics in the animal, which gets passed on to the humans, but they are still farmed in a more mass agricultural way. That's why sustainable and regenerative agriculture goes beyond organic and is even better, because in sustainable and regenerative farms, you're truly building the soil back up. You're putting inputs back into the soil and making a healthier soil and biodiverse environment.
And just to clarify, I feel like people often use sustainable and regenerative interchangeably, but I feel like there's a subtle difference in that sustainability is about maintaining what we have, while regenerative farming is more about healing and rebuilding what's been lost. It's just so interesting about creating systems.
That's absolutely
back
correct.
More than what we're taking.
That's absolutely correct. There now are some companies out there that are certifying organic farms as sustainable or regenerative. So it is that is like the new wave of what's going on in the organic industry right now. More and more companies are looking to get sustainably and regeneratively certified. A great film, it's a documentary on Netflix called Kiss the Ground that Woody Harrelson narrates, is a great film in terms of learning about sustainable and regenerative agriculture. The one negative I have about that film is they don't even mention the word organic. So organic is not even part of that film, but it's a great film to understand sustainable and regenerative agriculture and why farmers who are farming that way get so much better yields and they have so much better quality food and meat and animal products that they're raising. But that is the that is the new trend right now. That's the higher bar that's being raised.
So that's going to be another label that we can look out for on food and
Yes, it is. And as I said, there's a couple of companies out there right now that are certifying sustainable and regenerative. But here we are, you know, like in the infancy, like when we were with organic. You know, we have an industry that's growing. And there isn't a government regulation defining exactly what sustainable and regenerative is yet.
We need to come back, Joseph.
Well, as an industry, we're kind of writing the rules as we go along, like we did with organic back in the 70s.
Yeah.
You know, and so we're living by a strict standard that we're defining ourselves, even though the government hasn't caught up to us yet.
So there's only a couple companies now that are actually certifying in this.
That's correct.
Regenerative.
Yep. Sustainable and regenerative farms are now getting certified, but it's in its infancy.
That should be interesting to see how that unfolds. That into a discussion on the carbon footprint. And when we talk about the carbon footprint in food, that's a conversation you and I had. And in the past, not on the podcast, but that total energy it takes to produce it. Mm-hmm. And you talk a little bit more about sourcing local. In fact, it's really a benefit to the carbon footprint overall if we're actually importing it or bringing it from another source.
That's a great question, Kathy. Of course, buying local movement is real and genuine and good. And we all should try to buy local as much as we possibly can. However, here in the Northern Hemisphere, depending on where you live, you can't grow bananas or you can't grow pineapples. There's certain things you can't grow locally. So we have to source from foreign places, from elsewhere. And when I sold organic ingredients, my last company to SunOpta, and stayed on for 10 years and continued to grow the business, we did environmental impact studies and carbon footprint studies on what we were doing as a company. And they were in our shareholders' reports that we published. We did a study to show, because we at one time we were the largest supplier of organic frozen strawberries in the country. And they're grown in California and in Mexico mostly. So grocery stores that were on the East Coast of the United States, we did a carbon footprint study and we found out that taking our California grown strawberries and putting them in a frozen truck and shipping them across the country by truck to the East Coast to the supermarkets had a higher carbon footprint than if I took my organic strawberries frozen from Chile, put them on a ship, and in a ship, they got shipped directly to the East Coast to a port, and then they were trucked to the supermarket. That actually had a lower carbon footprint coming from Chile to the East Coast of the United States versus California. So, you know, you think, oh, it's grown in the United States, it's got a lower footprint. Not always true. It really depends on the commodity, the item, the geographic location. So yes, it is always better to buy locally wherever you can, but buying locally doesn't always equate to the lowest carbon footprint. And I also want to point out that people who go to farmers markets, which I encourage everybody to do as much as you can, you also have to be very careful because you can go to a farmers market and buy what you think is organic produce. But unless that farmer has a sign that shows that they're certified organic, if they're not certified organic, you don't really know whether it's grown organically or not. If you know that farmer, you've been to their farm and he or she is telling you that they farmed it organically and you've seen with your own eyes and you believe it to be true, then that's one thing. But if it's not certified as organic and he or she is telling you it's organic, you really don't know for sure. So be careful about that at farmers markets.
Okay. That's a really good tip. When I think about buying local or sourcing local, you're saying if we're going to a farmer's market, it's great. And making sure that if they're saying that it is organic, right? Two different, very different things. It's organic mm-hmm. and it's also local, and make sure that's credible. When we buy local versus buying something that's coming or being shipped, we're saving on fossil fuels that are being burned and transporting, say it was a strawberry from the East Coast to the West Coast. If we buy local, coming from somewhere, you know, another country or somewhere across the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, that's not a black or white answer. It you know, depend if it's a fresh blueberry,
right?
If it's a fresh blueberry coming from Mexico or California to the East Coast, it's probably going to have the same shelf life versus if you try to get a fresh blueberry coming from South America, it's not the same versus if you're buying something frozen. You know, buying frozen organic peas and corn, for example, grown in the United States, you're getting like it's the way in which they farm the corn and the peas, it goes right from the field right into a blast freezer and it's frozen very quickly. So in some cases, you're getting more nutritional value from a frozen pea or a corn than you are by buying fresh peas and corn, because the fresh peas and corn may have been sitting out for days and days before they're actually consumed. And corn, for example, the natural sugars in corn turn into carbohydrates very quickly after it's harvested. So the best tasting corn, believe it or not, unless it's absolutely fresh farm picked that same day,
right,
frozen actually has better nutritional value and tastes fresher than a fresh piece of corn. And it really depends on the item and how it's farmed and where it's come from. It's not a black and white issue.
Yeah, it's so interesting, but it's also confusing at the same time.
Yeah, it is confusing. And the average consumer just has no idea because you don't see what goes on behind the scenes in food production. But buying locally certainly is always better, and you can't always ensure the fact that when you're buying something from the United States versus offshore, it may be a better carbon footprint by buying it offshore than it is from buying something from the United States.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, how it all adds up. It's not just one factor.
It's a very complex system.
not to be figured out in one podcast episode.
No.
Possibly a multiple.
I would agree.
You've lived through the evolution of an entire industry from small farms and cooperatives to multinational adoption. And just out of curiosity, how do you see the future of organic farming?
Well, I think that demand for organic continues to grow. The supply continues to lag behind the demand. I think that organic will continue to grow. I think the more that it does grow, the more close we will see pricing come. The premium that people have to pay for organic is shrinking. it's getting closer and closer to conventional pricing. And the more we see organic growing, the more we'll see prices coming into parity or coming closer. I mean, at one time, you know, you pay 50% more. Now it's, you know, 10 to 15% more. So as we see it come down to 5 to 10% more than conventional, more and more people will convert, which helps more farmers convert. So it's, you know, it's like a chicken or the egg thing. We need for the demand to continue to grow, for the supply to grow. And I think that there's, you know, not only will we see organic grow, but we're also seeing agribusiness consolidate and grow also. So as much as I would like to not say that that's the case, that is the case. So the fact that we're still using, I'm going to call it the modern methods of agriculture, which is the monocropping and the tilling of the soil and GMOs, we're going to see that continue to grow too, unfortunately. But the more conscious people become of realizing that what we put into our body really does affect our health, and not only does it affect our health, it affects the way we're doing agriculture, and that affects the way we can help affect climate change as well at the same time. So my hope is that we'll continue to see the growth of organic and especially sustainable and regenerative agriculture, which is now just in its infancy and becoming more and more awareness in terms of what consumers want.
I love that you're talking about awareness and to what we put in our body. And just simply the purpose of this podcast is to just bring awareness to listeners about organic food, what we put in our body, how it's made, how it's produced, the choices that we have and what we pick to put in our body. And finally, if you had one piece of advice to someone trying to live more consciously and how they eat, buy, or even connect to the earth, what would that be?
I would say really try to cut sugar out of your diet. Try to cut as much seed oils out of your diet as you can, and eat a lot more fresh produce and live food, sprouts. Sprouts are some of the most nutritious things you could eat, and they're high in protein and high in nutrients. You could eat a more plant-based diet and eat organically, and it could cost you less than a traditional diet of eating a lot of animal products and processed foods. You could actually eat a more plant-based diet that is organic and spend less money overall than buying the animal products and the processed foods that the average consumer typically buys. But I would say eat a lot more fresh, live foods, less processed foods, and cut out sugar.
I love it. And I agree. It's a very powerful perspective. And it's a good reminder that conscious living just isn't about a lifestyle. It's a daily practice of choosing connection, and whether that's through what we eat or how we move or how we show up for our planet. And thank you, yeah. Joseph.
You're welcome. I always say that you can pay a little bit more now for your food, or you're going to pay for it later in your health, because it's not something that's going to catch up to you right away. Eating food that's got pesticides and chemicals in it and it's highly processed is eventually going to take its toll on your health over time. So it's, in my perspective, it's worth it to pay a little bit more now to have better health in the future.
That was Joseph Stern. Proof that doing right by our body can also do right by our beautiful planet. If this episode makes you look twice at that organic label before you buy it, then good, because that same curiosity is actually where the change starts. Not only in what we buy, but what we eat and what we choose to believe about the food that we decide to put on our plate. Remember, being embodied goes far beyond just the body. It's really about the choices we make, the awareness we carry, as well as the health we create from the inside out. If you enjoyed this conversation, please like, follow, and share this embodied podcast with a friend. It really helps our community grow and definitely keeps these conversations flowing. Thanks again for listening. And until next time, stay grounded, stay curious, and keep drinking your organic green juice.